make sure I've got my, yep, I do, okay. We're here for oral argument in cause number 02-23-151 CV. The panel for y'all today is to my left, our visiting justice, Ruben Gonzalez. To my right, Justice Dana Womack, and I am Wade Birdwell. And this matter was reset and scheduled down the road, and today is down the road. So we're set to hear oral argument. And if you would call the case, please.
The court will now call Life Investors Management Company versus Settlements Investors. May it please the court, Mr. Sean Quinn will argue for appellant. Ms. Aurora Temple Barnes will argue for Appellees Cross Appellants, Settlements of Texas, John Ted Bonham, and Richard D. Dean. And Mr. Aaron Christian will argue for Appellees ILS Enterprises, David Blackburn, and Nolan Wayne.
All righty, counsel.
May it please the court.
Sure.
Good morning, Your Honors. We appreciate you giving us the opportunity for oral argument. As the court already is aware, there was a lot of briefing in this case, but the central issue really is pretty simple and straightforward. And I would like to focus most of my attention on that issue, and that is whether the district court properly construed and applied an administration agreement and an operating agreement. But a little bit of background, LIMC, my client, specializes in the management and investment opportunities for life insurance settlements. And the way this works is that you find someone willing to sell their life insurance while they're still alive. They sell it at a discount. And then an LLC is formed that actually becomes the owner of the policy. The LLC has an operating agreement which controls how the LLC is operated, construed, and in this case, how money is dispersed. And once the insured passes away, then the LLC distributes the funds according to the operating agreement. This particular LLC, I'm going to refer to it as the McIntyre LLC, Mr. W.L. McIntyre. He had a life insurance policy worth $11 million. The McIntyre, W.L. McIntyre LLC was formed to own and have control over that particular life insurance policy. The managing member, ILS Enterprises, Inc., also was managing other policies connected with this type of business, but the focus needs to stay on the McIntyre LLC. Now, as we're getting down the road, Mr. McIntyre is still alive, it became clear that ILS simply was not up to the challenge of properly managing the McIntyre LLC, or the others for that matter. Money that was coming in was going to places it shouldn't have gone. Policy premiums were being missed. Of course, if you don't maintain the policy premiums, then the policy lapses, and then everybody loses. I mean, everybody loses their investment. So ILS, on behalf of...
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you because there's an awful lot of contractual language we've got to go through. Would you agree with me that the use of the word originators does not appear in either part two of the background where it talks specifically about the members receiving a proportionate share of the net death benefit according to their percentages, or in the 11.1, which is the mandatory liquidation provision, which discusses specifically the distribution of members of the death benefits.
Yes.
There's no mention of originators anywhere in either one of those provisions, correct?
Not in those provisions, but originators are defined in the operating agreement.
I understand, but that's the only place in the agreement.
Yes, sir.
That originators as a term is actually used and defined, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And in fact, the appendix that is attached to the operating agreement for the McIntyre LLC specifically provides for an originator's interest, but it doesn't identify who those originators are, does it?
The last page, correct.
Well, the first page of Exhibit A.
There are three named originators. And
for example, under the ILS Enterprises and McIntyre, both of those LLCs are identified as capital contribution services who will get the remainder of the death benefit of the policy in the tune of $2.75 million. So in all of these other instances, they're identifying policy LLCs as being a part of this agreement.
Right.
And the only instance on Appendix A with regard to distribution is literally originators, which doesn't identify anybody.
I understand, Your Honor, but the originators can be named and unnamed, and that's where the paragraph in that's quoted in our brief determining or defining who originators are made it clear that we have these three named originators and then others who also participated in providing services and doing other acts, maybe in the contribution of money, in order to forward the investment goals of the McIntyre LLC overall. The fact that there were others, I don't really believe is disputed. For example, if I may, when you get further, once the dispute about the how the money, the originator money was to be divvied out, okay, we received, LIMC received a proposal from some of the named originators that basically said, all right, this is how we want you to divvy the money up. And it included names of people in that proposal that were not named anywhere in the operating agreement itself.
Are we in a position to consider that? Because there's been an objection raised that evidence was struck, but then your response, you say, well, somehow it's referenced in another portion of one of the other summary judgments, since we're dealing with three summary judgments. But the evidence that, in fact, SOT and Bonham actually identified additional and others as part of their proposed distribution.
Yes.
Was objected to with regard to, I think, the third summary judgment. Am I correct in that regard?
I believe so, but Your Honor, one quick point. I came into the case after, right toward the end, so there may be specific rulings that I'm not as familiar with.
Understood. The difficulty I'm having is both sides say that this language is unambiguous. Okay, you say "and others" is unambiguous.
Correct.
But you have to look to evidence outside the four corners of the document to find out who the "and others" are. Okay. They say "and others" is unambiguous, and then they actually look to people outside the four corners and say, "and others" is supposed to be there, but only under certain circumstances, none of which occurred in this instance. Therefore, it's effectively a moot point of the contract. In either instance, we're having to look at evidence outside the four corners to determine what to do here, and you seem to be arguing that effectively Judge Fitzpatrick decided to make a credibility determination of whose interpretation was the correct one here, when in fact we can find ambiguity, can we not?
Well, Your Honor, with respect to ambiguity, you know, the word "and others" is not ambiguous. It means somebody unnamed, but yet as part of the agreement.
But again, somebody unnamed, the how are we to determine who those unnamed individuals are? Are we supposed to determine that based solely upon the, whether or not they were engaged and whether or not they insisted?
And those are the factual issues that meant that the court, well, those are the factual issues that should have prevented the finding on summary judgment.
Tell me, where you raised a fact issue as to who "and others" were. And if you're relying on their proposed distribution that included two others who had absolutely were not named as originators, how are we able to consider that given the objections that were made?
If you would look at the declaration of Terry Holland, he testified as to additional individuals that he would consider originators, and that was the evidence that we put forward as to who the others would be. Now, you can always have an objection and say, well, I don't think he or she did enough, I don't think he or she paid enough in, or whatever, you know, those issues may be. But they were identified, and they are identified in the record.
Okay. Is Holland's affidavit that you're relying on, or is it deposition testimony that you're relying on, and was it considered by the trial court with regard to the first summary judgment motion without objection, or was it something that came up later that there was an objection to?
It was part of the original responses and the original motions. Again, I don't recall if it was actually objected to. Again, I wasn't part of the proceedings at the time. But the court had access to that declaration before she made her rulings on the summary judgments.
Okay. What were the circumstances of ILS being replaced by SOT for to be manager? And why should we consider that not to have been an effective change?
Because of the administration agreement itself. The administration agreement was entered into by ILS on behalf of McIntyre LLC. The administration agreement has very specific terms as to the scope and authority of the administrator, which was LIMC, and delegated those authorities.
But it is subject to the operating agreement, which specifically gave provisions for which the managing member could be replaced.
Yes, but the LLC is still bound. The contractual obligation was between the administrator and the LLC. We're not arguing, and never argued, that ILS could not be replaced by the managing member. The position we're taking is that the new successor managing member, SOT, is still bound because the company's bound. And the agreement itself, the administration agreement, has very specific set of circumstances in which the agreement can be terminated. Now, there has been an argument that the authority that LIMC received was derivative, meaning almost as if ILS was to say, come and sit in my shoes, so to speak, and then once the shoes are no longer there, then we step out. But that's not what happened.
One thing I do want to ask that nobody addressed in the briefs, and that is, I am troubled, but I don't know whether I can be legally troubled or not. So what is your position with regard to the fact that the what appears to be the replacement issue that came up only occurred after SOT had filed suit to begin with, and then you had filed counterclaims with regard to that. And then all of a sudden, we're going to do some corporate house cleaning so that we now can change our position from where we were when we filed the suit and when we got the counterclaim to say, King's X, that's not actually what's on the ground anymore. And that, and so the basis for our summary judgment is something that we did after we engaged the court's jurisdiction.
The if I'm following your question, Your Honor.
In other words, ILS was the managing member at the time. SOT filed the lawsuit.
That's right.
Okay.
And ILS
and the entire
authority.
Thing about SOT becoming the successor manager didn't occur until everything was completely engaged in the 342nd District Court. So in effect, SOT and the other and Bonham changed everything on the ground with regard to the actual management, or attempted to, whether it was done legally or not is an issue here, but attempted to do that in the middle of litigation, and then said, now that we've created our summary judgment evidence, we're going to use that as a basis for summary judgment. Are you aware of any instance where the courts have allowed that to occur?
Not offhand, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I would also point out that if SOT had wanted to terminate the administration agreement, it should have followed the specific terms in that agreement rather than just simply writing a letter and say, well, we're now the managing member and you're fired. They had a roadmap. They chose not to follow it. And for that reason, their termination of LIMC as administrator was ineffective. Otherwise, the administration agreement would have to be ignored.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Go ahead, counsel.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Aurora Temple Barnes, and I represent cross appellants and appellees Settlements of Texas, John Ted Bonham, and Richard Dean. Now, though you wouldn't know it from appellant's brief, this case is essentially about uncontested summary judgment motions. There are multiple paths by which this court can affirm the trial court's summary judgment rulings, each of which are sufficient in and of themselves.
Okay, is the operating agreement uncontestedly in the summary judgment record of all three motions?
When you say all three motions, do you mean the two that...
Well, let's just start with the first one. The operating agreement, the basis of SOT's motion for summary judgment, the operating agreement was put into evidence, was it not?
Yes, it was.
Okay, and was the administrative agreement put into evidence?
Yes, it was.
Okay, so both the OA and the AA, and all the language of both with which we're supposed to be interpreting whether or not there's appropriate interpretation of the contract are before us.
Correct, Your Honor. Both of those.
And we're supposed to be interpreting it as a matter of law if we can.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay. So it's not exactly that it's all no evidence.
So it's that they're uncontested summary judgments. And when I say that, it's not that there's no evidence, it's that there's no evidence controverting some Settlements of Texas summary judgment motions.
Okay, but you understand under Rule 166AC, you don't have to contest a summary judgment to be able to appeal it, because the summary judgment record has to stand on its own on appeal. So they could have twiddled their thumbs through all three motions, and it gets up here, and we're asked to interpret evidence that it was actually in front of the trial court to determine whether or not the trial court got the interpretation correct, and they're in a position to do that. You understand that, right?
Yes, we do understand that, and we would also put forth that the only claims that are before you on that are the sufficiency of LIMC's claims, and as to LIMC, Defendant Holland didn't actually appeal the ruling on any of the affirmative claims or the rulings against them on summary judgment.
Okay. Well, let's get to the issue with regard to your position on and others.
Yes, Your Honor. So,
because that is before us. That's absolutely before us.
We agree, Your Honor, that is before you.
Okay.
So The operating agreement, neither party contends that the language is ambiguous. We would say that it is plain and unambiguous, and we acknowledge the fact that the language of "and others" is present. But when the originators were identified there, it identified three originators, three. It identified Compass Life, it identified Settlements of Texas, and it identified ILS.
And they were identified in a parenthetical, and the phrase "and others" is included inside the parenthetical, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And if you look at all the language in the operating agreement, there are no others identified. It left the possibility of others to be identified, but no additional persons were specifically identified.
Then go back to my question to counsel, which is why are not originators mentioned in the opening background or in the dissolution and distribution provision, the liquidation provision? Makes no mention of originators, and in Appendix A of the agreement, there's mention of originators, but they're not identified. This is the only place the originators are specifically identified, and there's a caveat and a catch-all of "and others" included.
It is the only place that they're identified, but that doesn't nullify their identification. They are identified in the language of the contract. It identifies the three, and the presence of the "and others" language does not render it ambiguous in and of itself. Now, if the court determined that it needed to consider additional extrinsic evidence to give context to the word, to the words "and others," and to see whether those additional "and others" were present, all of the extrinsic evidence demonstrates that there were no others identified. Just because it left open the possibility of others doesn't mean there were others identified. And when
there was no evidence to show that the LLC engaged any others to assist with either the capitalization or the strategic, I'm forgetting the word, it's sitting here right before me, but anyway, you know what I'm talking about, the second provision.
Yes, Your Honor. So when it talks about others that were engaged in that, there's a couple of issues there. So the only evidence put forward that looks to, that claims to identify those others were present or contributed to the LLC in a way that would qualify them as others was evidence that was stricken from the record on a motion to strike, and additionally on sustained evidentiary objections. So it was doubly stricken on both those grounds, not objected to and not before this court.
So when that. the hearing took place, it was transcribed, and that evidence was specifically referenced, and there was no objection to it. The silence of the attorney with regard to the correctness of that information is not something we can take into consideration?
You can take it into consideration, but it also was thoroughly objected to on motion and evidentiary, on an evidentiary basis. So taken as a whole, the evidence was wholly objected to.
So the proposed distribution that included the non-named originators is not before this court as far as you're concerned?
No, Your Honor, it's not a part of the record. It wasn't properly considered by the trial court, and it's not before this court in the record.
Okay. So what is the evidence that shows that "and others" is meaningless under the factual circumstances here?
So when you look at the extrinsic evidence that's properly in the record, the only additional evidence is the unanimous consent. That's properly considered. It was signed by all the members of the LLC. It clarified the intent.
That occurred during litigation, correct?
It did, Your Honor.
Yes, it did. Okay.
Yes, it did, Your Honor.
So what's your position with regard to the ability of a corporation to change the names in the game in the middle of litigation it initiated and asked the trial court and invoked the trial court's jurisdiction on with regard to a specific claim before all of that happened? In other words, what are you aware of where a party can actually make its own evidence as the basis for its summary judgment?
The fact that the unanimous consent was engaged and written after the litigation ensued doesn't invalidate the unanimous consent in and of itself. The members were entitled to take action to clarify and make clear the intent, but the unanimous
consent. That we
win. The unanimous consent didn't.
The judge, here's our unanimous consent. We win. Yeah, it wasn't that exact way when we initially invoked your jurisdiction, but we're going to clarify that right now.
The unanimous consent didn't change the intent of the parties that signed the operating agreement in the first place. There's additional extrinsic evidence by affidavits from ILS and other persons that were party to the operating agreement that said that the intention of the identification of the originators and that language was only to make the distribution to those three parties, and that those parties could additionally decide to distribute to others if they so wished, but the intent...
That's not what it says, though. So then what you're arguing is it was ambiguous.
I'm not arguing that it's ambiguous, but if it were to be ambiguous, the ambiguity would still find that the originators were the three parties and that there were no others.
Okay, you would agree with me that in order to be an and other, within the parenthetical, that you would have to have been engaged by the LLC and that you would have to have assisted with regard to either capitalization or implementation. That's what defines what an originator is.
Yes, to the company, W.L. McIntyre LLC, right. The head company.
But that's the only place originators actually, there's even any attempt to define who and or what an originator is.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so, but there's also nothing that defines what to engage means, and there's nothing that defines what to assist is, other than to the extent it's qualified by capitalization and or implementation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and I did notice that capitalization doesn't show back up at the end of that provision where it talks about and others the second time, because and others there is only qualified by implementation, not capitalization. So internally, and others in the parenthetical can include capitalization, but appears to exclude capitalization in the second part of it. So how are we as a court trying to figure out what and others actually means from the language? How are we to make that determination?
You would make that determination if you needed the additional clarification to look at the extrinsic evidence, which makes clear that the others was part of the contract language, and that there were no others identified by the managing members that met those qualifications for the capitalization or implementation pieces to the company. Now, there may have been other activities regarding the policy LLCs, but none of that has to do with being an originator as to the...
But your position at the summary judgment was that and others doesn't matter, that these are the only named ones, they're the only ones that matter.
That's correct.
Okay. But that's not how it actually reads. So it looks like we do have to go to extrinsic evidence.
And the extrinsic evidence in the record makes clear that the only originators were the three named therein, that there was no intention of, though the language is in there, that there were no additional others identified or included that qualified under those provisions, that there was no intent of having those additional persons in there. And while it left the option open, just because the company didn't put any others in there, it doesn't render it meaningless. It just means that there aren't any others that were determined to be entitled to those.
Okay,
funds.
But that's back to the unanimous consent.
It's also within the four corners of it, and then there's also the ILS affidavit talking
about...
Please
explain to me how it's within the four corners.
Because the four corners of the contract doesn't identify any others. There are no additional others identified and listed. If there were, it would say within the contract, okay, here are the others, and here they are listed out and give those. But there's nothing in the contract to
do
that.
So because it's superfluous, it doesn't matter. Because something else in the four corners doesn't say who and others are, even though it's defined as to engage and assist, we're to ignore that.
To say it's superfluous, because there weren't any others named, because it was an option that wasn't taken, doesn't necessarily make it superfluous. It just doesn't have any others that were identified with it. The language.
How about this? It unambiguously says that and others may be created at some point in time after the execution of this, but in interpreting it that way, it specifically means there has to be evidence of it after the fact.
Correct.
Okay. The other thing is if we use the unanimous consent from the time frame that it in fact occurred, Rule 166A-C specifically talks about controverting evidence from interested witnesses. That would seem to be like the penultimate example of interested witness testimony, is that the actual party gets to make up the evidence that's the basis for summary judgment, and that normally you cannot grant summary judgment on the basis of that type of evidence. And in fact, you, particularly with regard to matters of intent.
To talk about interested witnesses and to make that equivalent to the act of a company, to the vote of all managing members and of the members and the managing member to clarify the intent, I would not argue that those are equivalent, but that's not something that we briefed, and we'd be happy to put supplemental briefing in on that issue.
That'd be fine. How is, I understand that SOT wasn't a signatory to the administrative agreement, but my reading of the OA makes ILS pretty much God with regard to managing the McIntyre LLC. Specifically grants gives unrestricted delegation authority to ILS to enter into such an agreement. Specifically contemplates doing so in writing, which was done. So, and the agreement specifically says it's between ILS and the policy LLCs, which includes McIntyre, includes Lawler, the two Lawler LLCs, okay? And the member, at least with regard to McIntyre, in the agreement says he basically, the managing member gets to sign everything. I don't see where actually any vote gets to take place without the managing member saying you other members can vote.
We're not contesting that ILS had the authority to enter into the administration agreement. We acknowledge that it was entered into. It's just that SOT wasn't a party to it, and the ILS didn't enter into it as the company. It entered into it and did give derivative authority to it, but that authority would not superimpose and override all of the company documents, the managing member's intent and will. On that last point, and because I'm out of time, I would just say that on our cross appeal, the sufficiency of the evidence as to Holland is not before this court. The sufficiency of the evidence as to those affirmative claims is not. The only thing appealed here was LAMC, and its decision is just to determine whether Holland should be held liable for the damages on the claims for which he was also liable.
We weren't going to get to any of that stuff. There's just too much in this case to get to for oral argument. We appreciate your argument.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Aaron Christian, and I represent appellees ILS Enterprises, David Blackburn, Lawler Management, and Lawler Management 2.
Counsel just said something that you guys just entered into the administrative agreement on your own behalf. Is that true?
Yes, Your Honor. ILS is bound by the administrative agreement.
I didn't ask you that. I said, did you enter into that agreement solely for ILS? Or did you enter into that agreement as the managing member of the McIntyre LLC? And if not, where in the administrative agreement did you cut that caveat out?
Mr. Blackburn signed the administrative agreement as the manager. That applies to the policy LLCs that are listed in Exhibit A to the administrative agreement.
Okay, which includes the Lawler LLCs.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. My understanding of Lawler's, I'm going to jump to Lawler real quick because this is a quick point. My understanding of Lawler's argument is effectively that because there's nothing in the record that the Lawler LLC's operating agreements are not in the record. And frankly, the record's too big for me to go find that, but they're not in the record. Therefore, it doesn't show that ILS had the authority to enter into the administrative agreement for the Lawler LLCs, and therefore the indemnity wouldn't apply to them anyway.
Well, it's a little more specific than that, Your Honor, and the Lawler operating agreements are in the record. They're attached to both the ILS motion for summary judgment and the Lawler motion for summary judgment.
Okay.
But the point there
But I understood that there was a lot of reliance on the no evidence, no response aspect of it.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the Lawler operating agreements, and if you look at what, because the main issue here for my appellees is the expansive blank check indemnity that LIMC is trying to assert from Article 4 of the administration agreement.
Which, dealing with that specifically, your argument is because the second indemnity provision is not specifically qualified as to claims and or conduct of ILS, it is an expansive, overarching indemnity that's not tied to the first indemnity provision, which means it has to meet the conspicuousness and express negligence provisions.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And then also, ILS had no such right indemnity from Lawler that it could have delegated via the administration agreement to LIMC.
Well, is ILS the managing member under the Lawler operating agreements?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Are those identical operating agreements in at least with regard to substance to the McIntyre operating agreement? Because my reading of the McIntyre operating agreement is basically ILS gets to make all the decisions in very, very, very limited context can any of the other members do anything about it. And so if that's the same thing, then basically ILS gets to make whatever decision needs to be made about Lawler.
I would hesitate to say that it's the exact same operating agreement. I know the operating agreements between the different policy LLCs were drafted at different times, and so they're not always necessarily the same, and they do differ in certain regards. But Blackburn, or ILS, as the manager of the Lawler entities, did not have any such right of indemnity himself against the Lawler entities such that he could have delegated that right over to LIMC. And the administration agreement is very express in several places that it is a delegation of authority from ILS to LIMC. So with respect to that issue and
But it also is very specific that the only way to withdraw that delegation is either dissolution or by agreement.
Yes, sure, that's what
and dissolution is a little bit ambiguously defined in the operating agreement as the beginning, as the death event.
Yes, sir.
And the beginning of winding down the LLC.
Yes.
Lord knows what the beginning of the winding down of the LLC, because winding down also has a specific meaning, but winding down only occurs after payment. So and of course, LIMC was permitted to pay Mr. McIntyre's estate the full $1 million and the investor members $8 million before the dispute about the originators. So they appeared to have the authority to do those two things as part of the winding down.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would just say that is specific to the McIntyre LLC, and I wouldn't want to represent that the term.
Understood, but you guys are the ones who entered into the agreement to begin with regard to what you were delegating.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I've taken up all your time. If there's one big point you just want to slap me upside the face with, have at it.
Well, Your Honor, it's the delegation issue for one, and then one other point I would just mention is we think essentially all of the arguments that were raised by LIMC on within issues 4 and 5 on the ILS MSJ and the Lawler MSJ were likely not preserved for appeal because they were never raised in a timely response to a motion for summary judgment before the district court. They did timely file a response to those motions for summary judgment, but they argued entirely different issues. And I'll leave it at that, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, I just want to address a couple of issues that you've asked both parties. With respect to the "and others," I would agree with the court that it's vague. But just because it's vague doesn't mean it doesn't have any force. And as the court correctly pointed out, the position of the appellees is to just simply read it out of the agreement. Now, one of the powers the managing member has, and then, you know, later LIMC had, was to apply the terms of the operating agreement and determine who the "or others" were. And that was the heart of the dispute. LIMC is, you know, the effective managing member with the authority, was raising the fact that there were other people who contributed. They either found investors, they either, like GTH Holdings, actually put in the first $500,000 in capital, so they would be an originator. And some individuals who went out and found investment and helped secure the financing necessary to keep McIntyre LLC afloat, and also to make sure there was a payout to the beneficiaries. So summary judgment, we believe, was inappropriate because somebody has to come forward and say, here are the individuals that we believe, and that's what LIMC did. And for the court's convenience, Mr. Holland's declaration is at the record 2681 and 2701 through 2759. That was introduced in the record, and those facts, if the appellees wanted to dispute those facts, well, John Doe, Jane Doe, they're not originators. We don't agree with you. Okay, well, then you would have to have some type of factual finding to determine who originator is, given the language about, again, being engaged to help and be a part of the investment strategy of McIntyre LLC. But if you keep "or others" in and give it effect, couple it with the administration agreement's authority to LIMC, they're consistent, they're not contradictory. And to the extent there may be any vagueness, you know, the court should read "or others" in a way that gives it effect and makes it consistent with the agreements being read as a whole. I don't believe reading those two agreements as a whole, anyone could walk away by saying, well, there aren't any others. Also, the one of the arguments that has been made is that, well, you could have just amended the operating agreement. But it doesn't, the operating agreement doesn't provide that that's, you know, the procedure to go. And there's a good reason for
there's
that.
A lot of stuff in here that they didn't say anything about. For example, ILS could have been replaced as the managing member for not doing its job, but there's nothing in the OA that says what that means or what the basis for that happening is.
Yes.
Okay. It also talks about good cause, but that's a separate distinction. So there's a lot that's not in this agreement. All right. So close up.
Are there any other questions? I'm about done with my time or completed my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Matter submitted. Thank you all for your assistance with regard to this argument, and we will retire. If counsel, if you want to address, if either counsel want to address any of the matters that have been raised by the court during this hearing, we're generally pretty liberal about allowing post-submission briefing. So if for some reason y'all think, my God, Justice Birdwell has no clue what he's doing, his questions indicate he has no clue what this is about, please be gentle when you send us a brief, but you are more than welcome to send us one. All righty. Thank you all very, very much.